KLL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
This is Keeping the Faith. Our regular host, Steve Shoemaker, is away today, and I'm filling in as guest host. My name is Danny Otto. The theme of our show today is A Rabbi Encounters the New Testament. Our guest today is Rabbi Norman Klein, rabbi at Sinai Temple in Champaign since August of 1995. He was ordained at the Hebrew Union College, the Jewish Institute of Religion, in 1985. And prior to that, he did graduate work in a PhD program in English literature at Indiana University. In a few weeks, Rabbi Klein will be teaching a course on the theme of today's show at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Illinois. These courses are open to the public, and we will perhaps talk about that later on if people are interested in how they might sign up for the course. The idea of a rabbi encountering the New Testament or reading the New Testament might need a bit of explanation because we associate the New Testament as a Christian text. In my own experience in the last decade or perhaps a bit longer, Jewish scholars have enlivened the scholarship of the New Testament era, both the study of the texts and of the growth of early Christianity, by bringing their scholarship in the history of Judaism to bear on the Christian texts. And the reason why they are generating fresh insights is that historically, Christians have tended to study these texts, and we also even see the sort of language if one reads the Gospels or the other books in the New Testament, the emphasis has been to emphasize the discontinuity between Jesus and the emerging Christian church and the Judaism of the first century. And so the focus of a lot of the recent scholarship has been to talk about ways in which there's continuity between some of the key ideas that we associate both with Jesus and or Paul and some of the other themes of the New Testament. So I'd like to welcome you, Rabbi Klein, to the show today.
Thank you.
And perhaps you could begin by just telling us, as a rabbi, I know you have lots of responsibilities in your duties as a rabbi. What got you to go on this course of study on the New Testament?
Well, we have a regular adult education program at Sinai Temple, which I teach at, and we have a special part of that program called Special Topics in Judaism. And we've been following a series of mostly biographies published by Schocken Books, such as the biography of King David, biography of Spinoza. It's been quite popular. Many, many people from our congregation and a few outside have joined me in these discussions. We have them on Sunday morning and also once a month on a weekday for lunch at one of the local restaurants. And I decided that it might be nice to take a slightly different tack and get a book of about the same size as these biographies put out by Schocken. Actually, the label on the publishing, it says Next Books under Schocken. And they're of a small format of about 150, 200 pages usually, and they look pretty much exactly the size of this book. So I was gone to Amazon because I'd heard that a new Jewish commentary on the Bible was going to come out, and I was looking for it, and I found the Jewish Annotated New Testament, edited by two Jewish scholars, Amy Jill Levine and Mark Zvi Brettler. And when I ordered that book, up popped, if you like that book, maybe you'd like this one. And it's called The Jewish Gospels, The Story of the Jewish Christ. So I said, well, I'll try to see what that looks like. And since it ended up being about the same length as the other books, I thought I'd use that for my adult education. And once I started reading it and reading in the book I'd actually ordered first, The Jewish Annotated New Testament, I was very pleased and kind of amazed to see a different take on the New Testament than I'd ever encountered before. And I got more interested in it and wanted to teach something about it to the general community. Jewish community, that it seems like a popular course. I'm looking forward to seeing how many people actually enroll.
Well, the title of the book, The Story of the Jewish Christ, is interesting because I can remember I was a young adult when I was first engaged by the idea that Jesus was Jewish, and the argument for that was presented, well, he was circumcised as an infant on the eighth day. And actually, the last event that he did in his life, according to the Gospel of Matthew, was he presided over Passover dinner, which, of course, is probably the most important Jewish holiday. And so the Jewishness of Jesus, did Jesus practice the Jewish law? Did he eat kosher? Would you recognize Jesus as a Jew if he presented himself to your congregation?
Yes, we would. I suppose it is surprising to many people who are not Jewish to realize that Jesus actually was Jewish. But if you think about it for a second, realize that the homeland of the Jews is Israel, and the people who were living in that country, or at the time was a Roman province, but in that area, were mostly Jewish. So it would be unlikely that Jesus wouldn't be Jewish, because pretty much everybody in the area who was not a Roman was Jewish. And as to your question about how Jesus practiced Judaism, my understanding is that he followed the Jewish halakha, that means the law, and he was very concerned about the statements in the Bible that he thought perhaps some of the Pharisees were getting away from by introducing new laws. And so the more you read about the situation in which Jesus lived, the times and the various unrests and different sects that were developing, the more you realize that in many ways Jesus was actually a more conservative Jew than the Pharisees were.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the context of the first century and Jewish expectations at that time. I mean, Christians refer to Jesus Christ and sometimes forget that Christ is not his last name, but it's actually a title that is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew Messiah, and I'm using
Mashiach.
Mashiach and Christos. And so, a fascinating question is, what sort of Messiah, if insofar as Jewish people were looking for a Messiah in the first century, what sort of Messiah were they looking for? And I want to frame this by having you compare that term to the case in the book of Isaiah, where the Persian Emperor Cyrus, who's not even Jewish, is referred to as a Messiah.
Yes.
And so when you see that that term is a term that's not unique, it's used in the Hebrew scriptures, in the first century, what sort of connotations would that term have had when it was applied to Jesus?
Yes, well, it's very interesting to explore that term and that idea, because there were different understandings of who the Messiah was in the different sects of Judaism. And certainly at the time of the return of the Jews after the expulsion that took place many centuries before, 586 BCE, we say BCE, it's the same as BC,
right,
before the Common Era, when the Persians conquered the Babylonian Empire and allowed the Jews to return to their native land, Israel, the king of the Persians was considered a Messiah in the sense that he had saved the Jewish people and allowed them to return to their land. So clearly that was a different understanding of Messiah than we have in our contemporary culture and the different religious denominations that follow the and hope for the coming of the Messiah, or the second coming of the Messiah. But the one of the basic contexts, one of the basic understandings of what a Messiah was, even back in the time of Jesus, was that same idea that the Messiah will bring redemption to the people whom he is going to serve. And so it applies in that respect both to Cyrus and to Jesus.
Well, you know, let's explore the notion of the nature of the redemption that was sought after. So, I mean, granted, we have four Gospels, and there's not a perfect sort of overlap in the portrayal of Jesus in the four Gospels. But the first one in the book, if you pick up the text, is Matthew. And the genealogy that's given to Jesus there ties him through his stepfather, adoptive father, not biological father, Joseph, back to David. And so that's why I wonder, at least in the book of Matthew, do you think that the spin on it was more political in the sense that they were looking for someone to restore the glory? I mean, when the Jewish people at that time were thinking about David, they would have been thinking about sort of the glory days of the Jewish political kingdom, I take it, or?
Certainly he was a great Jewish leader and is seen as, you might say, the model or archetype of a Jewish king. When we had a kingdom, which was quite a while ago, it was about 3,000 years ago, till about 2,500 years ago. Anyway, the within Jewish tradition, we understand that when the Messiah comes, he will be understood to be a descendant in some way of King David. Now, it's rather difficult now, for sure, and perhaps even in the time of Jesus, to trace your ancestry back to about, in this case, it would have been about 950 years for Jesus to be traced back to King David. So I think what we can understand from the genealogy in Matthew is that the author of the gospel wanted to show that Jesus descended from King David so that he would be considered a legitimate Messiah from the Jewish point of view. Now, the question that I raise as a Jew about that is, what did that mean to the author of Matthew, that he was considered a legitimate Messiah? Did it mean that he was, as the Jews have come to understand it, a person, a human being that will help the Jews achieve independence and autonomy and bring them back to their land and by extension, create a kingdom that will be a model of peace and goodwill to the entire world? Or did the idea of identifying Jesus as the Messiah have more to do with what the current, as I understand it, Christian idea is, which we can talk about this at some length because it's really quite interesting, that Jesus is in some way co-equal with God, that Jesus is one of the Trinity, so to speak, which is a wholly different idea from what the contemporary Jews think of as a Messiah.
Well, before we get to that, and, you know, I know we have a lot more than we can talk about in the given hour that we have, but you know, to push the question about the significance of the term Messiah and the genealogy and tag it into David, the standard Christian perception was that the problem to which Jesus was the answer was the problem of the sinfulness of humanity going back to Adam and Eve, and that Jesus, one way or the other, and is the solution to that problem. Was there any of the varieties of Judaism's being practiced in the first century, the various ways in which people were practicing, various Jewish sects, was there any precedent for seeing the human condition primarily in those terms as a kind of personal sinful condition rather than the sort of earlier notion of covenant that as long as the Jewish people, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, fulfilled the terms of the covenant, God will bless them. And so the meaning of that, it has much more to do with sort of this life rather than some sort of larger metaphysical situation that humanity finds itself in.
Mm-hmm. In order to answer that question, I have to get to a slightly different topic first. And
okay.
Remind me if I go too far astray here.
No.
The idea of the different sects that were in existence, if you can call them that, different movements or groups of people within Judaism is, to me, one of the most fascinating topics that led me to do more reading on the subject, because we don't know that much about it. We know a lot, but not very much considering how important it was. For instance, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, we suddenly realized that there was this group called the Essenes that we'd heard about from Josephus, but didn't know very much about. We knew about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We knew about the people who followed John the Baptist. But we still don't know all the different groups that existed within the Jewish community. And one of the very interesting ways that I think a Jew can enter into the reading of the New Testament and get a lot of interesting Jewish information from it is to try to figure out how Jesus is an example of, or the leader of, or the founder of a sect of Judaism. So that's the background out of which I would answer that question. Could you repeat the question?
Well, before I repeat the question or before we move on, let me invite our listeners to join the conversation. Mm-hmm. So we do have telephone lines, and you can call in with questions and comments. And if you're in the local area, the number is 217-333-9455. And if you're listening on the web and it's a long-distance call, you can use 800-222-9455. And we would be happy to have anybody listening to this show call in with questions and comments. So I think, you know, at this point probably the important thing to understand is that at the first century in that context, we wouldn't refer to Judaism as if it were one single thing that had an absolutely uniform set of beliefs and practices, there were varieties of expression.
It's very important to understand because of the fact that we kind of think now that religions have kind of a monolithic existence, even though we have so many examples to the contrary. You know, what do you believe as a Christian? What do I believe as a Jew? What do Buddhists believe as Buddhists? As if all of each religion believed exactly the same thing and followed a certain dogma. But the reality is, at least with Judaism, which I can speak with some more authority on, there's quite a, a significant number of people who are Jews living today who think of Judaism as largely an ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, a people.
Right.
And certainly back in the times when Israel existed as a kingdom, and later when it was conquered or occupied by the Romans, it still was the case that the people who thought of themselves as Jewish thought of themselves as Jewish because they lived in a Jewish culture. They spoke a Jewish language, or several of them, actually. There was Hebrew, there was Aramaic, and other languages that Jews spoke. And they followed the cultural norms of Judaism, which included observances and, you might say, religious cult behaviors that were common to the Jewish people. And the whole idea of what we now think of as religion, I don't think most people in the time of Jesus would even understand what we were talking about if we said, what is your religion?
Right.
Because it was always tied to being in a group at a certain place at a certain time.
Mm-hmm. In the description of your course, you say that you're going to consider the parables in the New Testament and compare them to the Midrashim, rabbinic stories, anecdotes, interpretations. And one of the things that makes the figure of Jesus and his teaching so interesting is that so many of the things he had to say were indirect, except when they weren't. And so I would like to talk about, you know, your take on some of the themes of the Sermon on the Mount. But then at some point, I would also like to talk about the sort of way in which Jesus answered questions with a question or with a story that still, you know, Christians who nurture and cultivate these stories don't agree on what they mean. And so was that a genre in the first century? But so I've got two things on the table here. So let's go back and talk about the Sermon on the Mount for a minute, because that's probably the longest single sort of recorded speech that we have. We have it in two versions, so there's some common themes in both versions. One of the striking things, such as turn the other cheek, don't respond to evil with evil. What sort of a context would that have found itself in at the time that he said something like that?
Yes, well, I don't think you could ever describe the Jewish people as a whole as pacifist. In other words, there's a strong element within the Jewish culture and the religious practices and beliefs that says that since life is so important, if your life is threatened, you have to defend yourself. But at the same time, within Judaism, there's a very, how to put it, practical way of dealing with potential threats. And certainly Jesus's teaching to turn the other cheek could be seen in that light, that it's better to win someone over by not, you might say, stooping to their level of violence rather than escalate things and make it worse.
Sure.
So that would be a strain within Jewish practice as well. I think perhaps in the development of Christianity that grew out of things like Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, the degree of turning the other cheek as an ideal was more developed by Christianity than it ever was in Judaism. But as a potential option, I think it's there. You can react to, say, someone's negativity with a higher level of negativity or with a reduced sort of a way of sort of pulling the rug out from under that negativity.
And, yeah. I mean, it has to be said that, while on the one hand, Christianity has preserved the text, it also has to be said that, you know, at about the time that it became a majority religion, it figured out ways in which turning the other cheek was not expected or a desirable thing as it needed to after Constantine and became an empire religion. The text became a kind of embarrassment that mostly we don't know what to do with. And there are some other sorts of things, and you might have some things out of the Sermon on the Mount that come to your mind that strike you as interesting, worthy of comment. One of the things, you know, that, you know, I'm of the age where I'm beginning to think about retirement and a pension, and I'm taught by my culture to save and to plan ahead and so on. And so Jesus has this thing about have no thought for tomorrow. Look at the birds of the air and the lilies of the field and so on. They have no thought and God takes care of them and so on and so forth. And so, you know, well, that is really a very, very hard statement for anyone, not only in our culture, but I think historically as well. People had a notion that accumulation was a good thing and so on. And any sort of light you can shed on that in terms of what might have been in the air in various rabbinic or midrash at that time? Or is that something that, as near as you know, I mean, would be an original contribution?
Well, in a sense, it is an original contribution because it's so extreme. There certainly are examples in the time that Jesus lived or a couple of centuries before, I mentioned the Essenes earlier, where they decided to live in a society where they had a very minimal amount of material possessions. And I would say that would fall under the broad umbrella of Jewish practices, because the main thing that Judaism teaches, Rabbinic Judaism, which is an outgrowth of Pharisaic Judaism, is that material possessions are not bad, But to focus on them to the exclusion of being a good person and to make accumulation your main goal in life, that is very bad. And that it's much more of a an admirable trait to give in excess of what is demanded of you in order to help others and share your wealth or whatever possessions you have, but not to impoverish yourself and make yourself a dependent upon the community for your sustenance. So in that respect, Jesus may have been going further than the other Jews, the other Jewish sects of his time would hold as a truism. But it's a little hard to say what Jesus actually meant when he said, you know, when he assumed that God would provide. It's to this day, I think, people are constantly wrestling with the question of, does a good act always get its just reward in this life? And there's a lot of evidence to the contrary.
Well, speaking of just rewards in this life, and we might come back and talk if there are any of the parables and so on that you want to comment on, but you raised the topic of the just reward, and one of the very stark images is Jesus' description of the last judgment. And in Matthew 25, I believe it is, or 20, so he has all the nations gathered before this figure that's referred to as the Son of Man. And now, of course, Christians insert Jesus as the Son of Man, but the term Son of Man is an interesting sort of phrase. And then you've got the separation of the sheep from the goats, and for some reason goats don't turn out good in this. They're the bad ones. And the basis for the judgment is all based upon what you have done. And so he enumerates a list of things. You've visited the widows and imprisoned and given clothes to the needy and so on and so forth. And on that basis, you're one of the sheep and you get your eternal reward. And on the basis that you didn't do those things, you get eternal punishment. So there are several things I'm interested in this. One is my impression is, you know, and I'm reading your scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, as someone who was raised and trained as a Christian, that in the Torah and in the ancient texts, there's not much interest in a kind of afterlife or last judgment. You follow God, you obey God because God has certain expectations, and if you do, the reward or punishment is now. So two aspects. One is the figure of the Son of Man. What would that have meant to a Jew in the first century? Then the other is this notion that was there a movement of Judaism that began to sort of go in that direction? And I'm curious about the origins of that idea just in terms of that culture.
Yes. Well, the Son of Man is actually one of the major topics developed in that book that I mentioned earlier, The Jewish Gospels, The Story of the Jewish Christ by Daniel Boyarin. And he makes a very interesting point that I guess is debated among scholars, but he convinced me that Son of Man, which is the way Jesus refers to himself very frequently in the Gospels, means literally partner with God. What I mean by that is the most famous text in the Jewish Bible that deals with that mentions that term is the book of Daniel, where Son of Man is a person in a being in the form of a man called Son of Man arrives in an image of Daniel in one of his dreams on a cloud, and is then seated next to the ancient one who is presumably God the Father. And so this being, which was obviously conceived of by a person who was within the Jewish community, because the book of Daniel was written during or shortly after it was during the Maccabean Wars against the Syrian Greeks. And So my understanding is that that's what the Son of Man refers to, and it comes from a Jewish text. Now, this is not to say that all Jews believed that there was a co-ruler or God and a Father and a Son, but there were clearly beings, divine beings, within the total, you might say, range of Jewish belief that were in ways serving God or assistants of God and so on. Call them angels, call them what you will, and this Son of Man was one of them.
And in the book of Daniel or in this tradition, would that have been conceived of as a unique individual, or would there at various times in history perhaps someone appear as the helper of God that would be worthy of this title?
As far as I know, that's the first use of it within the Jewish textual context. There certainly were angels in the Jewish Bible that visit important figures in the Bible, and usually often announcing a birth of a son to, say, Sarah or whatever. And there were three angels there. And so there are other beings that are, you might say, helpers of God. But the Son of Man being is first mentioned in the book of Daniel. That doesn't mean it's the first time it existed. It just means the first time we have a record of it.
Mm-hmm. In a minute or so, we need to take a break midway through the show. Is there anything, any of the parables or any of the teachings of Jesus that you would particularly like to comment on that you find fascinating or engaging in light of first century Judaism? And then I'll do a little preview of upcoming shows.
Okay. Well, there are many, many that I would like to talk about. I can find one.
Let me just say, while you're looking, to remind our listeners, this is Keeping the Faith on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Danny Otto. Our guest today is Rabbi Klein on the topic of A Rabbi Encounters the New Testament. And if you are interested in participating with a question or a comment, you can call in at 217-333-9455. Or if it's long distance, you can call at 800-222-9455. I caught you off guard there.
That's all right.
So
I'm just trying to find a specific example that I can share with you. Okay, so let's take this parable. In the book of Matthew, chapter 18, it says, "For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he began the reckoning, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him, and so he could not pay. His Lord ordered him to be sold together with his wife and children and all his possessions, and payment to be made. So the slave fell on his knees before him, saying, 'Have patience with me, and I will pay everything.' And out of pity for him, the Lord of that slave released him and forgave him the debt. But that same slave, as he went out, came upon one of the fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii, and seizing him by the throat, he said, 'Pay what you owe.' Then his fellow slave fell down and pleaded with him, 'Have patience with me, and I will not pay you.' But he refused. Then he went and threw him into prison until he would pay the debt. When his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their lord all that had taken place. And then his lord summoned him and said to him, 'You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had the mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you?' And in anger, his lord handed him over to be tortured until he would pay his entire debt. So my heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart." So one of the many reasons why I'm interested in this is there's a parallelism going on in this parable that you find in Judaism. In other words, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. A great teaching that many religions have, that Judaism is has stated in the Tanakh, in various forms in both our Bible, which we call the Tanakh, and in rabbinic literature. For instance, the famous Rabbi Hillel in the first century BCE was asked by a person who wanted to convert to Judaism, tell me everything you know about Judaism while standing on one foot. And Hillel had patience with this person and stood on one foot and said, do not do unto others what you would not have done to you. All the rest is commentary. Go and learn it. Meaning essentially that your relations with your fellow person, fellow man, should be done on a fair basis, and you have to learn the entire Jewish law in order to be able to do that in the right way. The parable also is quite interesting because it talks about forgiveness and the importance of forgiving, and that there's an irony where the slave who owes so much asks for forgiveness from the master and he grants it. But when the other slave asks to be relieved of his debt to the first slave, he will not allow him, even though it was a very small amount. So I think the kind of underlying humor, the ironic aspect of that story, is also something that you find in Judaism, the sense of the punishment shall fit the crime.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Good. I'd like to shift the conversation and look more at what happened after Jesus and the emergence of early Christianity and how that factors into some of the work you're doing. But I would also like to announce some of the upcoming shows for the next several weeks. I will be returning as host next Sunday, January 20th, and my guest will be Professor Jonathan Brown, who is Professor of Islamic Studies and Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. And we will be talking about issues in contemporary Islam in North America and try to understand the challenges that Muslims face in adapting to our society. The following week, on January 27th, my guest will be Professor Michael Budd he's Professor of Catholic Studies and Political Science at DePaul University in Chicago. And we will be talking about Catholicism in contemporary society, and especially looking at some of the issues that emerged in the last election cycle with the role of the Catholic bishops in speaking out against some of the policy of the Obama administration, and then the pushback with nuns on the bus and some issues surrounding that. So we welcome you to join us the next 2 weeks as we carry on this conversation. Keeping the faith. We've got about 20 minutes left, and I would like to switch the focus a little bit away from Jesus to what happened after Jesus was no longer present. And so after the four Gospels, the structure of the New Testament is you have the book of Acts, which is a kind of narrative chronology of some of the events of the first decades. And it seems like even for someone like myself who's not a scholar, a casual reading of that shows that at least initially the 12 who were designated as Jesus' disciples or apostles continued to see themselves as Jewish and that they were faithful and devout practitioners of Judaism. And the signature event in Christian history that is focused upon in terms of Trinitarian theology when the Holy Spirit comes— Pentecost is actually, as I understand it, an important Jewish holiday.
Shavuot.
Which celebrates Moses receiving the Ten Commandments.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Correct. It's a holiday that occurs in the spring, early summer. It's usually around the end of May, beginning of June.
And Christians calculate Easter from the Jewish dating of Passover, because obviously those Jesus' arrest and so on occurred on at Passover. And so I think I'm not clear. Is Pentecost a movable feast? Does Pentecost? How do you date Pentecost?
Well, it's inherent in the name itself. Shavuot in Hebrew means weeks, the plural of week. Hmm. And it's a Shavuot takes place a week of weeks after Passover.
I see.
That means 7 times 7 plus 1.
Okay.
So 50 days after Passover, there's Shavuot.
Okay. So that does move alongside the...
It's like many aspects of the Jewish calendar, it's fixed in the Jewish calendar, but from the, you might say, the Western calendar, the generally accepted calendar that we all live under, especially students at the university.
Yes.
It looks like many Jewish holidays, including Shavuot, move around a bit, but they're on the same day in the Hebrew calendar. It's just a, it's just an apparent moving.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I take that as evidence that the first, at least initially, the disciples and the followers of Jesus considered themselves to be Jewish, and then were introduced to this character, Saul, who is renamed Paul after his conversion. And at least on the surface, it appears that Paul is emphasizing a discontinuity, that one is either a follower of Jesus, a Christian, or a Jew. And, you know, so it raises an interesting question, is who properly is the founder of Christianity? Is it Jesus? Or is it Paul? And was Jesus a Christian, or is Christianity religion about Jesus? And the character of Paul, I think, is interesting. I'd like to have some perspective on Judaism at that time. So he is a Jew, and by his own identification, prior to his conversion, was the most devout of devout Jews. But he was also a Roman citizen, and his language was Greek. And so I don't know if there's any evidence that he knew Hebrew, or whether he was, his knowledge of the Jewish scriptures was in the translation. So talk about this character of Paul and what insights you have on him and his contribution to this and how you respond to him.
Yeah, well, Paul is certainly a fascinating person, and I could certainly continue to read about Paul learn a lot more. But I can tell you my understanding of Paul is he himself also saw himself as a Jew his whole life, in my opinion. In other words, the development of Christianity as a separate religion may not have occurred until a couple of centuries after Paul, because there was this fluidity within the sense of religious observance in the world of the Roman Empire that allowed people to see themselves as part of a certain ethnic religious community, even though they had differing points of view about their religion. So, for instance, I'll give you one example. In case of Paul, he says that he was punished by the rabbinic courts. We don't know exactly why. You know, he was whipped twice with 39 lashes at two different occasions. I think it was twice. It may have been more. And that sounds bad. That was a punishment at the time, but it was only given to people who were within the Jewish community. In other words, there would be no reason to punish for a certain point of view about Judaism or statement that you had been making if you weren't part of the Jewish community. So both Paul and the people who were judging him considered him a Jew, but making a bit of a break from, you might say, what they thought of as the mainstream. What I really would like to emphasize here, though, is that there was no reason to think of Paul as other than a Jew. It's just a Jew who at the time recognized in Jesus a part of God that he wanted other people to follow. And the we're seeing a lot of the life of Jesus and the life of Paul from a perspective that is much removed from their circumstances. And we are projecting, I think, onto these people a sense of our understanding of the fixed nature of religion. But actually, religion is very fluid and dynamic, and not only goes through changes over time, but within any given time is quite varied. So people can believe that they are part of a certain set of beliefs and are part of a certain people, despite the diversity of their points of view. And I think in that respect, I don't think Paul ever ceased to think of himself as Jewish. And he was spending a lot of his time trying to get people who were Jewish to believe in Jesus and not leave Judaism. When he went on his travels, he went to a lot of diaspora Jewish communities trying to convince Jews, some of whom he succeeded in convincing, to follow him. And then he broadened his ministry to non-Jews. And when he did so, he wanted those people to also be seen as included in, you might say, the practice aspect of Judaism, even if they couldn't be accepted as full Jews because they wouldn't be circumcised.
Well, yeah, that raises a host of questions.
Yeah.
You know, and among them is, you know, the issue of circumcision, I guess, is delicate when we talk about adults, males converting, you know, what that requires. And so, you know, in the book of Acts, it records Paul going back to Jerusalem and sort of striking a bargain with the 12 that they will be the apostles to the Hebrew people and he will go to the focus on the Gentiles, although, as you say, he does visit exiled communities in modern, what we think of as Turkey and other communities. But, you know, it's sometimes his invective seems a little bit extreme. So in Galatians, for example, he comes down really, really hard on the circumcisers, the faction of the circumcisers, by which he means Peter and James, and even says at one point, you know, I wish these people preaching this, their knives would slip and they'd castrate themselves, which is a statement that someone would make who's quite angry about people who disagree with him on this point. Was there any precedent for other Jewish groups at that time that were going to non-Jews? The Essenes, for example, would they have tried to proselytize and go to Gentile non-Jewish people and get them to follow their message?
Well, not the Essenes so much as the Pharisees. There's actually a statement in the New Testament that the Pharisees would go to the ends of the earth to make a convert. So there was a period of emphasis on conversion among the Pharisees. I don't think the Essenes did that. In fact, they were a kind of very exclusionary community. And I think when you talk about Paul and his anger over this issue of circumcision, it was really an argument regarding whether you have to be totally integrated in the Jewish community before you could become a person who accepted Jesus, or could you be a person who didn't go that route first and just accepted Jesus and then gradually took on, you might say, the customs of Judaism without ever joining the people and the religion of Judaism. Mm-hmm. And Paul's position was you could do the latter, and the people who were he was arguing with were saying, no, you've got to be Jewish before you can become a believer in Jesus. And clearly, Paul won the day.
Paul won the day. We have a caller on line one. We'll go to the caller now. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Please come with your comment or question.
Yeah, awfully glad that you brought up Hillel and the period of the century before the common era of Christ. Weren't there any number of messiahs during that period of time of which whatever scriptures one might be looking at, which could would include the Christian New Testament and other Hebraic or Aramaic or Latin or Greek or other whatever that would allow for a great amount of getting rid of excess literature that taught things that you might not agree with.
Do you have a comment on that question?
I didn't understand the very last part of the questioner's comment about the getting rid of other literature, but I could address everything but that. What I would say is certainly that is true, what you said about there being other figures in the Jewish community that were representing themselves as messiahs or messianic leaders, or however you'd like to say it. There's not a lot of we don't have much records about these people. They're referred to in rabbinic literature, which the actually first rabbinic document we have is the Mishnah, which was completed after the 2nd century CE. So it's not exactly synchronous with the period we're talking about. But we do have some evidence in Josephus, who was a person who lived in the 1st century CE, and who talks about these other messianic figures and the sad fate largely to which most of them fell victim of, because the Romans saw them as potential leaders of revolt. We have one very, very important figure within the history of Judaism that represented himself as a messiah. This is a person called Bar Kokhba, who led the Bar Kokhba rebellion in the middle of the 2nd century CE, which ended up being a total disaster for the Jewish community, because this was a little more than a century after the Romans had destroyed the temple and slaughtered and enslaved many Jews. And Bar Kokhba's rebellion also was put down by this very large and powerful Roman Empire after a couple of years of fighting. And again, many Jews were enslaved or murdered. And that was the end of the major part of the Jewish population living in the area around Jerusalem that was called Israel. That was the true beginning of the extensive diaspora community. So, yes, there were many, many other figures that identified themselves. In this case, Bar Kokhba was identified as the Messiah by Akiva, famous Jewish teacher of the time. But none of them are recognized now as messiahs from the Jewish point of view. We call them false messiahs.
We thank you for your call, and we have just short of 5 minutes left. If there's anyone else who would like to call in with a question or comment, you would be welcome to do so. There's another one of Paul's key ideas, which, you know, actually has been controversial to some degree within Christianity itself, and that is his notion of grace and his juxtaposition between grace and works. And so earlier when I talked about the vision of the Last Judgment, it was all based upon what someone has done. If you've done these sorts of things, you get a reward. If you've done other sorts of things, you get a punishment. And Paul juxtaposes grace and works. And by grace, he seems to mean that you are saved from the human condition by the grace of God. It's not anything you can do to merit it. You can only accept it through faith in Jesus. Not exactly. And he doesn't seem to have known a great deal about, you know, sort of the details that we talked about earlier in the Gospels, the requirements that Jesus seemed to lay down his followers. But is there any sort of analog in Jewish movements that would correspond, or is this another something we would say is sort of an innovation of St. Paul, a new idea that your salvation is not based upon what you do in a concrete sense, but more your attitude towards God as expressed by your faith in Jesus as a Savior figure?
Well, I think in some ways the Essenes are the closest we have to that kind of point of view, where they felt very, very strongly that even the Sadducees, the priests of the time, were not doing the rituals in the temple the way they should be doing it, and they formed their own cult or subculture within Judaism, emphatically talking about the importance of following the religion, which is a way of saying having faith, and that was extremely important for the for individuals, but for the community as a whole. Otherwise, they would be punished for not doing it the right way. Generally speaking, Judaism is much more concerned about what you do than, and I think that's pretty consistent throughout the history of our religion, even in various evolutions, that belief is certainly a factor, but it's how you act on that belief that's most important.
We have a caller on line one who will need to speak quickly, and we'll have time for a very quick response. We have about a minute left. Line two, go ahead.
Hello. Jehovah's Witnesses believe that Christ was crucified on a tree, and I believe this is incorrect because the Romans used the symbol of the cross as a sign of death to tell people that if they didn't obey and serve the Romans, that they would be punished in the most excruciating form of death. Do you have an opinion on whether he was crucified on a cross or a tree?
5 seconds.
Yes, I think it was a cross because that was the Roman punishment for treason.
Okay, thank you for your call. This has been Keeping the Faith on AM 580. I'm Danny Otto filling in for Steve Shoemaker. And we welcome you back next week when we have Professor Jonathan Brown to talk about Islam and contemporary American society. And thank you for your participation.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Lisa Braltz. In March, I'll be hosting WILL-TV's cooking show, Family Dinner Favorites. We'll demonstrate recipes, talk about food and beverage pairings, and much more. We're also collecting your prized recipes for the Family Dinner Favorites cookbook. Please share your favorite recipes with us by Friday, January 25th. Send them to willmembership@illinois.edu or to recipes, WILL-TV, 300.
I'm Diane Nolan, host of WILL-TV's Mid-American Gardener. This summer, you can join me on a unique journey to England to discover some of the country's most famous gardens. On the 9-day tour, we'll explore Castle Howard, Hidcote Manor, the Cotswolds Villages, Sissinghurst Gardens, the Hampton Court Flower Show, and much more. For more information, go online to will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.